With weariness, curiosity, and good intentions, we come to you on this Wednesday morning to figure out just a little bit more of what is happening in our world, and we do so this morning on this 26th day of February. It is a Wednesday. It is 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. Let me introduce the panel to you. I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome you to the proceedings. We also want to always say that you can be a part of this program. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org. Here's the deal. We get a lot of letters. A lot of the letters are similar. The other day we got, I think, 400 or 500 letters, and you know, we obviously can't get to all of those, but they're very similar. We try to pick ones that that kind of speak for the mood of the room or give a different perspective, and also that are short and to the point, which is always a lovely thing to have happen as well. Panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce everyone to you, and we will begin our foray into Stuart Rice, Honorary Chair of the University at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences, and Faculty Associate at the Bergman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Fran Berman, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. You always make me sound so exciting. I'm just going to make you follow me around and introduce me whenever I need to be introduced.
Well, you got a pretty good bio there, Fran. It's pretty damn exciting, and I have nothing to do with that. That's all your accomplishments.
Yeah.
Well,
and none of my failures. Have you ever noticed that nobody includes their failures in their bio?
No. That's why. I mean, the rest of the world's out there to point that out. So,
yeah.
But we're all
good
here.
Morning, Joe.
I won't do that. And it's an absolute delight to hear your voice coming through my headphones. So, welcome to the program. We also welcome Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security. Or security. It's going to be one of those days. And cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Bob Griffin, good morning, Bob. How are you?
Joe, good. It's nice to be back. I haven't been on with Jay in a long time. Jay, you still have chickens?
I do.
You know, I just want to note, I got to compliment Jay that he bought chickens before the price of eggs sort of rivaled platinum. I don't know what you're going to buy next, but whatever you do, I'm going to buy into it. So if, like, you start to collect alpacas or moose or something, I'm on the J train now.
We had llamas once,
yeah,
many years ago.
Wow.
Yeah, we didn't shear them or anything, but after we bought them, a yarn place opened up in Altamont. But we were not as meticulous, you know, we're kind of laid back with animals, so we did not groom them the way, let's say, Terry Conroy from Altamont grooms gorgeous llamas. We were a little more matted sometimes, so we did not sell the stuff.
If I ever open a bar, the matted llama would be a great
the
name.
The matted llama.
Yeah.
Well, go halvesies with you.
That's how I... I can think of no better place to drown my sorrows these days than the matted llama.
It's good.
Jay Jochnowitz is the voice you hear right now, semi-retired editor at large, columnist, editorial writer, and all at the Times Union, and we thank Jay for being here. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning to you. Was it weariness or weariness was your first? It was weariness, curiosity?
It was weariness, but weariness works too. I'm not gonna distance myself from that word, but no. Weariness.
What were the three? Could you do the three again?
Oh, I don't know.
Weariness, curiosity, and good intentions.
Yeah, there you go.
What are paving elements to hell, Joe? For 1,000.
Good intentions, yes. Well, meaning in good intentions in the sense that we have the best of intentions to try to move us forward, not to navel gaze and set us back. But, you know, sometimes that I think all of us are finding it difficult at various times to do that. So, but here we go. You know, we should, you know, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, apropos of that, I've got a guy on my Facebook feed, and I can't quite figure him out, but every time, you know, I post something that, you know, kind of talks about the the state of affairs, it's almost like he's trolling me, but I'm not sure. He says, so what more are we going to do about that than complain? Because if all we're going to do is complain for 4 years, the Democrats are going to lose again. And when I say it like that, it sounds, yeah, okay, so he's not trolling me. But I said to him today that it's not bad to know what's going on and to be able to talk about it and put it into context and then, you know, eventually figure out what it is you want to do with it. But I appreciate his comments. I don't think he's as bad as sometimes I thought he was. Anyway,
we should just be I always know that Fran especially, you know, just wants there to be happy stories and rainbows and kittens and all the good stuff. And so I'm going to start off with that.
Nothing wrong with rainbows.
Absolutely. No, I agree with you 100%. And that's why I'm going to start with the story, because this morning we wake up with a big, beautiful bill. It's a big, beautiful bill.
Big and beautiful.
Big and beautiful. Yep. And so here's what happened. The House Republicans narrowly approved a framework Tuesday for President Donald Trump's legislative agenda. This was back and forth. They didn't know whether they were going to have the votes or not. And they got it by a whisker. And it sets off a sprint with the Senate to reshape the tax code, implement strict new immigration policy, drill for new energy resources, and spend billions on national defense. The vote, 217 to 215, would allow Congress's GOP majorities to bypass a Democratic Senate filibuster, though what's known as the budget reconciliation process, but Republicans still face significant challenges before they can pass what Trump has taken to calling his big, beautiful bill. The House and Senate must agree on competing approaches, even though both chambers have now passed their own version of the legislation. Some tensions within the GOP were on display Tuesday. Conservative hardliners and moderates alike threatened to buck Speaker Mike Johnson and sink the budget. Moderates fear its $2 trillion in spending cuts will force the GOP to slash Medicaid benefits, a political third rail in toss-up districts. But hardliners say budget cuts don't go far enough. The Senate has already passed its own budget resolution under the assumption that House Republicans would falter. Democrats were united against the bill and attempted to thwart a GOP head fake over it. Republicans acted as though they planned to postpone the vote after a lengthy negotiation with a quartet of holdouts. As Democrats left the chamber for the night, the GOP called up the measure again, forcing the minority to rush back. Two Democratic members, Kevin Mullen of California and Brittany Pedersen of Colorado, whom the GOP did not expect to be in attendance, emerged from hideouts to cast critical votes. I think we've proven to the Senate and to everybody that with President Trump's support and with a good product and working together, we can achieve anything, said the House Budget Committee Chairman Jody Arrington of Texas. I think that small majority forces you to work together. That from the Washington Post. This from Bob Griffin.
So I have a different name for this. It's the rapid raping of revenue is actually what we should be calling what occurred last night. You know, part of the bait and switch, and you may have heard a heavy sigh, sort of these high school parliamentary games, they are not reading the population correctly. I mean, the House and Congress, because there is very little stomach for this type of garbage right now. What happened last night really is a bill that is designed to camouflage and hide where the cuts are really going to come from. So the language that they used was that they directed cuts from each of the subcommittees. So rather than being truthful and saying, listen, we're going to cut Medicaid, they said that we're requiring a cut of $880 million from energy and commerce. Okay, but energy and commerce, if you're going to get that type of money, you have to cut Medicaid. If you look at some of the other areas, they are going to have to cut SNAP, which is the food program for children and poor. They're going to have to be looking at agricultural subsidies. So they are not being truthful with the American people. They are also not being truthful to the fact that they are cutting. They voted to cut budgets that are part of the direct network of benefits that keep people alive in order to give tax breaks back to the very, very wealthy. And you know, what was the figure you used, Joe? Was it $2 trillion in spending cuts? But in reality, with this and the tax cuts, you know, you're starting to look at adding in the next 10 years 11.25 trillion more to the deficit. This is an emptying of the public coffers for the good of the 1%. And if you wonder who the 1% are, go back to inauguration, look at the oligarchs that were standing on stage, and every one of them benefits from this, and everyone who is not on that stage, including the four of us on the show, will be paying the freight for them to have even more money. And I think one of the things that infuriates me the most, Joe, is that I want to remind members of Congress, and including people like Mike Lawler, who, find your spine, Mike. You just screwed over your district. It's our money. Okay. They're treating this like, we're making these cuts. We're cutting these services. And I know they're playing this game about efficiencies, but in reality, this is money that you took from us as part of the taxing program. And now you're taking from us again to redistribute to the incredibly wealthy.
Fran Berman.
Oh, geez.
It was so good that you were
moment of silence for those.
This will be
lost.
One of the 17 times that I don't hang up because I love you all so much. let's see. I think the bill is very consistent with what I'm hearing from the adolescents in the White House and Congress. We like rich people. We don't like poor people. Let's get rid of those programs that help poor people because, honestly, we don't like them and they just muck up everything. We don't like diversity. We don't like immigrants. We don't like universities. So, let's just get rid of anything that would make life easier for any of those folks. Apparently, we care about fraud as defined narrowly by whoever's around. We don't care about debt, though. So, if all of this fraud is supposed to help us balance the books, we don't care about that. So we like loyalty. Loyalty is good. Not to the flag, not to the Constitution, but, loyalty to elected individuals and unelected individuals. So I don't know. That message has been consistent and clear, ever since the world changed. And this is another example of, how that message is being delivered.
Jay.
There's a lot to unpack. I think one of the first things that could be done with this, that if the Democrats are looking for something to do, is explain what the New York Times explained very clearly, and to keep hammering home on this point, that the tax benefits of this bill will be greater, not just in terms of dollars. When you give rich people a tax cut, it's by its nature going to be bigger than mine. I kind of accept that. But as a percentage, it's going to be bigger, too. So that's not fair. And I think people, when that is explained to them, can understand that, that, you know, and grasp onto that. And it's a simple message that ought to be hammered home, that this is a, as you said, you know, this is a raping of the federal revenue. And the idea that they're going to be taking away, you know, what they have to take away to achieve this is important. You know, a lot of people like to think Medicaid, and I think it was talked about in either the Washington Post or the Times story, someone said these are not just welfare people, which is, you know, a cold way of putting it. But if that's your if that's going to be your attack on the bill, well, okay. But it is. It's going to be you're going to see cuts in breakfasts for kids, school lunches. You probably, I think Musk in his crazy, one of his crazy moments, floated the idea that kids should have to do some sort of work in exchange for their food subsidies at school. You're going to see, and I think this may well jump over into Medicare, which I said to my wife the other day with a word that I can't use on the air. I said, if you mess around with old people, you're going to find out that we're not as old as we look. You're not, you know, we're not talking octogenarians here. You're talking about, you know, people in their 60s and 70s who don't want to have, say, the $2,000 cap that Biden achieved on their drugs taken away. Trump has talked about getting rid of that, from what I understand. So, you know, this is, or at least thrown it out in one of his many word salads.
Let me pause you there. We'll be right back and continue the conversation. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning. We're talking about the House narrowly passing a budget bill yesterday, a big, beautiful bill, as the president has called it and is calling it. And whether it stays, I mean, assume it'll always stay big. Whether it still stays beautiful or not in the president's eyes is another question mark. Is there anything else you wanted to say?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. Just to kind of close the loop on the children in particular, the Times did some nice breakdowns of this, what each committee has been assigned and how much they have to cut and how much spending there is. And on the child nutrition and student aid category, the amount they have to work with is $722 billion. The amount they have to cut is $330 billion. That's half, give or take, 40%, somewhere in there. That's an astounding amount of money to have to cut from any program in government. You know, when they talk about, like, you know, you have to do a 5% cut, a 10% cut, they struggle to do that. But to say you've got to do a 40% cut, well, you know, kids are gonna go hungry. And students are going to be screwed in the process. The other thing that leaped out at me, two things that leaped out at me with this package were, one is that they have $562 billion in cuts that haven't even been assigned to a committee. It's just like, well, we'll also do that much to make the package work, you know. But and the fiscal hawks went along with this. There are, and they're going to increase along with the tax cuts that they're talking about, $100 billion in military spending for the biggest by far military in the world, the most expensive military in the world in any case. And I guess what I'm left with is, how does this do anything to generate jobs, and how does this do anything to generate to lower prices, which I thought were two of the biggest issues around.
Can I dig into the Medicaid issues just for a second, too? Because my theory, and I've seen this from a couple of other sources, is that the targeting of Medicaid is because of the population it serves, that it serves the truly underprivileged and children, and therefore they don't have the political voice. And the reason that they're not talking Medicare cuts right now is because the going after the elders is a third rail. So again, this is another example of an absolutely morally bankrupt Congress. I mean, think about what we're talking about. We're talking about giving the very wealthiest more money to go buy their yachts, and we're willing to let children starve in this country. Now, I know the GOP will keep them in their thoughts and prayers because, you know, anytime, you know, we see children getting shot in schools, that's their only answer. So now that as we start to see students or children starving to death, I'm sure that's going to be their response. But there should be outrage everywhere in this country over what this budget and this pathway is going to do to us as a society, and the idea that we would knowingly let people suffer in this country in order to continue to overinflate the budget for our the quote national security is just an anathema to everything that we stand for.
I mean, Fran, I think you made the point first, and it's a really good one about it does show about what they don't care about, and it certainly seems.
Yeah, I mean, and by the way, I think adolescents are great. We were all adolescents, and our kids were all adolescents. But adolescence is not known as a time when one makes the most measured and thoughtful decisions. I mean, that's not true for a lot of adolescents, but it's you know, somewhat true in general. So no knock on adolescents. I love you all. And in fact, I teach many of you in my classes.
yes, I loved the expression, Fran. I thought adolescents in the White House just summed it up beautifully. There's a lot of other adjectives you could use, but...
Yeah, but this is a family show, so yeah. You know, the other thing I think, and this is another thing I would ask the listeners to correct me on the correct definition, is you just see us sort of sliding into all of the characteristics we think of as a third world country, right? You think about crumbling infrastructure. You think about disrespect for the neediest and poorest and most in need of services, parts of the populace. You see dramatic gaps between those who do the best and those who do the worst. And my question is, you know, how fast are we going to get there? And stuff like this, no. It's hard to imagine human beings being so thoughtless about one another. All of what I do for a living and all of a lot of what I care about is the public good. And to see the public good so tattered and so inconsequential in all of these decisions. And that's not to say these aren't really hard decisions. A lot of times, all of the time, we have these competing priorities. But we should be able to trust, in part, the public sector to promote the public good. It's not the job of the private sector. It's not really anybody else's mainstream job. But it is the public sector's job. And so, I don't know, like a lot of the listeners, I haven't figured out exactly, beyond the things I'm already doing, what more dramatic thing I can do. But it's pretty heartbreaking. And if there are any listeners that don't wake up and read the news and aren't depressed every day, you know, we should hear from them because maybe they have some things to share with the rest of us.
That's a great point. Bob, how do you think the negotiations between the House and Senate are going to go?
I would like to say that, you know, I always felt that the adults were in the Senate, and I'm just not sure how many adults are left there. I think the Senate has a different approach. In fact, I know they have a different approach. I still think it's relatively draconian. It's not as in your face as the House bill. I think they're going to have trouble reconciling, and I think they're going to have a lot of challenges once the details of these cuts become public, unless they can slam it through really quickly. And again, this is the, you know, this is the rapid piece of the rapid raping of the revenue. They have to do it before people really understand and can begin to mobilize. And this has been the playbook from day one of this administration: is hit everybody with as much of this garbage as you can, hide it behind stupid crap like renaming the Gulf of Mexico. So they're gonna try to do this as quickly as they can, which is also part of the strategy that they worked yesterday is trying to figure a way to make it filibuster proof so that the Democrats in the Senate don't have an opportunity to throw as many obstacles in the way. And so far, Joe, you know, it's the Senate's behaving as you sort of expect. When there's not a big vote coming up, Murkowski from Alaska and Collins will get up there and clutch their pearls and talk about how they're going to stand up for people, and then they fold every time there's a damn vote. The nut jobs, you know, the Hawleys, the Cruises, the Rands, Rand Paul, they're doing their normal idiocy. So I'm not optimistic. And again, I go back to what I think is correct about the American population is that in a very short period of time, I can already feel. It feels like the pressure is already starting to build at the ground level. When I'm starting to see people coming out into the streets, even in wintertime, in the winter we've been having, there's already starting to, I think, I'm starting to sense a level of unrest. I'm also starting to sense an economy that's really a lot shakier than people want to talk about.
Okay.
And the consumer confidence or whatever is being measured in the latest polls and surveys is going down significantly. Which is why I think those ultimate questions of, you know, is this creating jobs and is this lowering prices, I think are going to be essential as time passes on this. And you're right. I think if you don't, if they can't ram this through, and there's no way they're going to ram this through with the Senate, the two sides are far enough apart that you're going to have to be talking about this for a few days. And even a few days in this climate is a lot for people to, you know, for some momentum to gain, at least in terms of explaining it. And I was thinking, kind of in a devil's advocate sense, how would you put the right spin on this? And the right spin would be, how do you deal with Medicaid cuts and so forth? And even if they go into Medicare, with some tweaks, how do you deal with child food, child nutrition programs and all that stuff being cut? The answer from a conservative would be, well, that's what government does. And if we're going to cut anything, it's going to have to be in those areas because, you know, we've larded up government with all these social welfare programs. But the other side of that is, why are you doing the cuts? You're doing the cuts so rich people can benefit. And we're talking people who, you know, somebody pointed out the other day the huge amount of money that Elon Musk put into Donald Trump's campaign to help get him elected.
$250 million.
And it was we don't think to get to a trillion or to get from a million to a billion, how much it is, and then to get to 100 billion and then to get to 500 billion, which is around what his net worth is. What an infinitesimally small portion of his wealth that is. It is greater than if I gave $10 to a politician. It is less than if I gave $10 to a politician out of my revenue, out of my income. So the rich have a huge investment in this guy. And as you pointed out, they were all up on stage, all of the Capitol on Inauguration Day.
Well, and they're making sure, you know, I don't know if we're going to talk about the cabinet meeting, but, you know, Trump's cabinet is meeting today, and of course, you know, President Musk is going to be there because I think he thinks that Donald's too stupid to run his own cabinet meeting, so he's going to make sure that Trump stays on message. He's literally bought himself into the cabinet meetings. And for people at home thinking, well, you know, you're just picking on, you know, on Elon. He's a successful businessman. Do you realize that Musk and his companies have been subsidized by us, the taxpayers, to the tune of $38 billion, Joe? Think about that.
Yeah.
We're talking about letting children starve when this clown has received $38 billion that has created his worth. Think about that.
People say, well, look at all the good he's doing with electric cars and going to space and doing all this stuff. Okay, fine. In the land of hard knocks, why didn't you do it yourself? Why did you need the government to do it for you? Or put in $38 billion is a lot of money. And you watched the progress of that, which actually started with SpaceX. I think he was getting money for SpaceX before
first.
He was getting money for Tesla.
Yep.
This is amazing. And I'm not sure I want Elon Musk having a reach into everything that he has a reach into, including our satellite systems. But here we are.
All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have letters from listeners, and we welcome you to join that group. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue our conversation after this short break. Well, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have a lot of letters. We're talking about the budget. We're talking about the fact that the GOP actually, and I say got the vote. I say actually got the vote. It's not like that. I was surprised. I think maybe in several parts of the day yesterday, even the GOP was surprised that they got the necessary votes that they needed. So we go to our letters this morning, and it's a good place to start to get a sense of how people are feeling about what's going on. L says, I am listening and I do not disagree, but I wanted to play devil's advocate for a second. Do we think perhaps that maybe they actually think that what they're doing is for the public good? It is well known and documented that Trump has a real obsession with Reagan. And do you think that maybe they/he actually believe that trickle-down economics works? Perhaps the issue is just re-education. Thanks for all you guys do.
I think this is a really interesting letter, Joe. And I would like to think that. I would like to think there's actually a political philosophy, one which I admit I don't subscribe to and maybe don't understand, behind what's going on. The thing that makes me think that that's not true, at least from Trump, and I don't even know about Elon, but it's very inconsistent. All the things that they're trying to do are inconsistent. And the thing that it's consistent for is more like consistent for, and I am not a professional here, greed and narcissism and things like that. But when I think about, I read a really interesting piece, and I forget who in the New York Times interviewed him, but it was a long-form piece, a long-form interview with Steve Bannon, whose ideas I also do not subscribe to. But at least there seemed to be some sort of philosophy about populism that was very different from mine, but it was a philosophy. He seemed to be, his ideas seemed to be consistent with that. To me, you have to start at the very base. I mean, for hundreds of years, so the difference between all parties, Republicans and Democrats, surely have been that they have different philosophies about safety nets and the public good and the role of business and all of this, the role of public services. And one, in different times, one could argue those back and forth and different ways of doing government, like governments all over the world do. I don't see any of that right now. I would like to think that it's maybe a notion of a different philosophy, one that I don't understand, I don't subscribe to, I don't think is good for anyone. But I don't see a philosophy. I see a lot of whiplash. I see a lot of inconsistency. I see a lot of greed. I see a lot of loyalty. I see to an individual, not to the Constitution. I see a lot of narcissism. So I hope the reader is right. But I don't see it so far.
I would argue that there is no philosophy that Trump is a grifter. It's all about him. It's all about about his money. And let me give you a perfect example. Okay, we're attacking immigrants, right?
Yes.
So immigrants are bad. They're taking jobs away. Unless you want to come to this country for a $5 million gold card. I mean, I saw that today that Trump wants to you know, if you're ultra wealthy, you can buy your way into this country. I don't know if he's looking for another wife. I don't know what his game is, but is immigration bad, or is it just that people who have to work are bad? It's also interesting to me that you look at someone right now who we didn't elect, who has more power than any elected official in this country who is here illegally. Think about the manipulation of our immigration system in order for Elon Musk to even be here. But they will then take a position against immigration in ways that they are. So it's impossible for me to say that there is any light of goodness coming out of this crowd. I really do see that. I think they see this as their opportunity to take advantage of the rest of us in ways that they have been unable to do in the past, that this is a unique opportunity and they are jumping on it. And the problem is that this they're attracting the like-minded vileness of the country. It's almost like a distilled vileness in this administration. So you look at the deputy director for the FBI. I mean, that dude shouldn't be anywhere near a law enforcement organization, let alone the deputy director. So I would sort of say that no, and even let's be honest about Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan couldn't get nominated in the current GOP. He would be either a rhino at best or a liberal.
Yes. Jay?
Yeah, I the gold card really got to me too. I mean, it's
doesn't
not
sound like I mean, it's like the John Lovett Saturday Night Live skit. It's like, you got a green card? What about a gold card?
And now he's calling it Green Card Plus. That's one of the things he also called it.
Green Card Plus. Well, that's good. Now with these features.
We have, to be clear on this, have always had a program for this, where if you were a wealthy investor and wanted to come to the United States, you could get in with under certain conditions. And they are sort of talking about that with this, that you can't just buy it for $5 million, but you have to have a plan. You have to open up a business. You have to have a certain amount of job creation, like 10 jobs or something like that. You know, as we've seen in New York with economic development, it's real easy to get around that kind of stuff and pretend that you're going to create jobs and not do it. And, you know, people asked about, is this going to include all the Russian oligarchs who want American citizenship? I would argue that for Donald Trump, it's not a question of American citizenship that he's looking for. It's whether they can legally contribute to his campaign for, possibly a third term, or he'll that's a selling point within the Republican Party as well. And it would be within the Democratic Party if they could get money from them. I kind of lost it after the green card. Sorry.
No, it's hard to figure that all out, right? I mean, it's
and the other the other point that I wanted to make on that is, again, we're seeing a kind of lawless situation where Donald Trump throws out an idea that almost certainly has to go through Congress. They can't just eliminate a program, and this for the longest time, and I don't know how you're going to square this. The mantra had been get in line. There's a process to immigration. This skirts it, potentially legally, if Congress goes along with it and replaces there's a letter, number, name for this program. It can be done. But the question is, as you point out, while you're vilifying immigrants, requiring them now to you're expecting undocumented people to register, which is just ludicrous. You're throwing people out of the country. You're putting $170 billion into potentially building detention camps, along with the wall that was once supposed to cost only $10 billion. And at the same time, you're vilifying all this. You're saying, well, if you have money, you're good. Yeah, it's as obnoxious as everything else we've talked about this morning.
Go ahead, Fran.
It's interesting to me because if you look at the zero-sum game, now, I think it's not correct to paint all immigrants with a broad brush. You know, they don't all work on farms or in kitchens or in stuff like that. But a lot of immigrants do. And so now a lot of a really important part of the economy is going to be reduced, diminished. And of course, as a person from academia and looking at the very bold attempt to pretty much gut higher education, we have a lot of students, and I'm in computer science. So, you know, this has been sort of the gold ticket for a long time. Computer science students are having trouble finding jobs. And I'm not sure what these folks think, whether, you know, now, you know, we have people in need of jobs. They can take the jobs in the kitchens, on the farms, on, you know, whatever, in the service industry. We have, you know, it just seems like there's so much disrespect for the kind of characteristics that different jobs need. If you send somebody out into foreign service, they have to understand the landscape they're in, how the country works, all of the really complicated relationships. You can't do all this stuff with newbies. And, you know, these are business people, and business people, one would expect to really understand the nuances of the markets that they are dealing with. So that's another thing that mystifies me, that even sort of standard business intelligence that tells you when you're likely to be profitable and successful and when you're not, and tells you what kind of workforce you need and what kind of workforce is not useful for you. You know, none of that seems to be part of this calculus either.
Well, we are talking about a president, though, who
we're late, but go ahead.
Bankrupted a university, an airline, a casino. The list goes on.
Yes. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue this conversation, and we'll move on to other things. It'll get so much more cheery. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Stuart Rice, Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences. Fran Berman is with us, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Bob Griffin is here, and J.J. Ochtenwitz, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, and editorial writer for the Times Union, joins us as well. We thank you all for being with us, and we welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Right before we went to break, we were talking about a letter that we got from a listener who said, okay, but maybe this, like, can we take this on its face that maybe we're trying to go back to a different time and trying to embrace the Reagan era?
And I think it's a fair point that when you look at the budget in the very big, broad strokes, if I was a Fox News analyst, if I was a right wing radio host, I could make conservative sense out of this. I would say that this is smaller government. These are big cuts. The government is about, social programs and so forth. And the only way you're going to do this is with some pain. The only way you're going to make significant cuts is with pain. So you, out of this, you're going to get somewhat smaller government. You're going to get some more fiscal responsibility, and you're going to get lower taxes. And those are big conservative checkboxes. And I don't think you can just say that everybody's insincere in that. The thing becomes problematic for me is when you start drilling down to the details of this and you ask yourself, what are you doing all this for? Well, you're doing this to give big tax cuts to the wealthy. You're not growing jobs, which is the other half of the conservative equation, I think Fran used the word trickle down. Where is the trickle down in this? I'm not seeing it. This is just a giveaway to the to what I've taken to calling lately the job slashers, not the job creators. Elon Musk came into government. This is a guy who has slashed more jobs. He hasn't created them by any means. And now he's in the federal government taking out tens of thousands of jobs. If you live in Washington, that's a big deal. You've got a lot of jobless people suddenly in your hometown. That's not growing jobs. So you can make reality out of this. But the point was, can people be sincere and support this job? I think absolutely there are Republicans who can be sincere and support it.
Yeah, it's not trickle down. It's pump up. And, I mean, they are trying to take the country back. It's not to the 1980s. It's the 1930s.
Yeah.
Diane says Reagan never called himself nor said the word king. So that one's out the window. Yeah. Then we also go to Diane, who said, I'm so tired of hearing God's name invoked in the immoral doings of the Congress. As if doing that, it makes it okay to take food out of children's mouths. We as a country have lost our way. All right, let's hold there on the letters on that subject and move on to another subject. And that is Doge. And this is a story that obviously the story that keeps on giving. Obviously, a lot there and a lot to try to get your head wrapped around sometimes. But yesterday, the big news was that 21 staffers of the U.S. DOGE service announced their resignations, citing, among other worries, quote, mishandling of sensitive data. These are people that Elon Musk himself hired and put into that position. And the his folk were upset with what he was doing. So the headline in the Washington Post today, Doge's grab of personal data stokes privacy and security fears. When one wants to talk about data, it's hard not to think about Fran Berman, so we'll bring her on board here. This is a group of people who justify their work for the U.S. DOGE service as a dogged quest for government efficiency, but people with deep knowledge of federal data systems and cybersecurity say they're skirting guardrails meant to protect sensitive data from misuse. Fran, how do we know?
Yikes. First of all, let's talk about the real world, and especially the way with the real world was a mere 2 months ago. And people worried about fraud and abuse in the real world, as they do now. And there was fraud and abuse in the real world, as there is now. Perhaps there's going to be more now. But in the real world, 2 months ago, all of the agencies, or most of the agencies, had a position called Inspector General. And those Inspector Generals had offices, and their job was to investigate the agencies and make sure that everything was on the up and up. So I currently am, probably not for long, on the Citizen Council of the National Endowment for the Humanities. I'm thoroughly techie. And we got regular reports from the Inspector General at the NEH investigating, you know, how money was being used and, you know, whether things were being fair and all kinds of things. And they give these agencies a grade. So then, of course, Congress has some options to investigate, and the executive branch. And so there was a pretty robust system that worked a lot of the time to look into fraud and abuse. Now we have DOGE. A lot of those inspector generals have been fired because DOGE is doing the job. And DOGE is pretty much running rampant on the usual checks and balances for lots of things, including sensitive information. So sensitive information around health, sensitive information around financial systems, social security numbers, people's incomes, whether they've been incarcerated, their student loans, their bank records, their salaries, you name it. The government has this information on us and in its wisdom has decided that that information is private and it can't be used to exploit you. You don't get your Social Security benefits coupled with a bunch of other databases and have people just decide, yeah, you're getting too many benefits, we're going to cut them. Now some journalists have said, and I don't disagree that this might happen, that these databases that are full of private information can be weaponized. And they're going to be used, I don't know, but they might be used for a number of things. So for one thing, they're actually being fed to AI. Now, AI is really good at giving you patterns. Everybody knows that, and trends. There is training data that has come out inappropriately in AI responses. AI is biased. AI is often not correct. In the best of possible uses of AI, you have humans in the loop vetting things. So you can be sure that if AI gives you a suggestion that or gives you a, quote, fact, unquote, that it's something that is useful for you. Not clear how this information is being used in AI. It's being used in a lot of other things. You can imagine, and some of this has not happened, that grant recipients, are now coupled with all kinds of other kinds of data. We're already seeing grant recipients denied funds. If you think about sort of gutting the people who are doing research to stay on top of what's going on in the world and to try to understand complex systems, there's no way the U.S. is going to be first. You know, all of those, all of that research is really being focused on sort of the forefront of knowledge. And that's where we want the U.S. to be. So that's pretty scary that information is being used to deny grants. People could be denied Social Security payments or a disruption in benefits or a different way of figuring out how much they earn based on putting this information together. Who gets to do it? Not the people with checks and balances before. It's also an incredible cybersecurity risk. So now what these folks are doing, folks who have not been trained necessarily to deal with private information and to use checks and balances, is they're making it easier to get this and easier to combine this. And all of the techniques they're using can be used by bad agents from outside the U.S. as well as bad agents inside the U.S. So one thing for folks to know, and I won't be too long with it, I promise, is a lot of this information is protected under the Privacy Act of 1974. And this meant that information has to be handled with security clearances, by federal employees who have the right training, et cetera. But no dice. You know, these folks are special government employees. By the way, that's what I was when I worked with the NIH as part of their advisory council like 20 years ago. And, you know, but that doesn't really give you a security clearance to look at somebody's Social Security number. So it's bad news. And it's not really clear where it's going, but there are so many places it can put people at risk and really muck things up. It's hard to count.
I want to get to our other two panelists in just a second, but a quick follow-up, which is when you have the two dozen people who got up and resigned yesterday, What does that tell you about the situation, Fran, of having some knowledge of that world, or a lot of knowledge about that world, of what it means when people suddenly say, "Oh, this is so bad. What is that thing? Oh, it's a spine. Okay, bye."
Well, I'm hoping, as probably you are, Joe, that at some point this is just going to cross the line. And if you're in the DOGE service, you're really seeing it firsthand. And I'm hoping, with no inside knowledge here, that people just decided it's just too much. And I don't want to be part of this thing that is highly illegal and arguably immoral. You know what? Every morning I search the news for, you know, crocuses in the snow. People who are just going to say no to things that are just patently horrible. And I look for that in Congress. I look for that, you know, in the agencies. And my heart goes out to all of these civil servants, which have been doing such hard jobs for so long with no recognition, really, to speak of, and not big salaries. And they're doing it because they care about the public interest. And they've been enormously important to us. And now they're having to figure out, how do I pay my mortgage? How do I send my kids to college? You know, how do I do my groceries? It's not okay stuff. So I have deep respect for the people who have said, I'm not doing this. On the other hand, and these are things I think about myself, it's like, how long do you stay in there so you can try to use whatever, you know, influence you have inside the job before you leave the job, before it's such a slippery slope? And because oftentimes you can do more good on the inside than the outside. So I don't know what made these folks change their mind, but I really respect the fact that they decided not to do it.
And Bob stumbled out of the matted llama in the early hours of the morning, left unawares to look for porpoises in the snow. It writes itself.
It does. You know. Yeah.
Wow. That would be crocuses in the snow.
Crocuses.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just saying.
So a couple things I just want to note.
I'm sorry. Did you say crocuses earlier, or
no,
did you say porpoises?
You said crocuses.
Crocuses.
Oh, I thought you said porpoises. Okay.
There
got
are
it.
No porpoises.
I know.
Snow,
I didn't. Oh. I didn't. I'm sorry. I
okay,
screwed that
of,
up.
Of course,
did he
when
sigh?
We cut education, people might not know that. So, you know.
Well, I know. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
So, so a couple things that I just want to remind all of our listeners. Okay, because we've said a couple times on the panel today, if Congress does their job, okay, DOGE was not set up by Congress. All right. It was set up as a by fiat by a guy who's declared himself to be a king and is operating independent right now of both the courts and the legislative body. I mean, basically, we have a rogue group which is controlling our government. I mean, this is the classic definition of a coup. Also, let's talk for a second about data. What they're doing scares me on multiple different levels. Okay, the government was never meant to be efficient. Okay, because to be efficient is a threat to our civil liberties. That's why you have different systems. That's why our personal protective information about our taxes is supposed to be different from our Social Security, which is different from our health. These systems were not ever supposed to talk to each other. They are not supposed to be efficient because government can't be trusted with this data. And what we're doing right now is not only are we allowing a rogue interest, access to all of our personal data, we don't know what they're doing with it. We don't even know where that data is going. We don't even know what servers they're taking this data to. Joe, this is really scary. So let me lay this. You want a dystopian view of the future? you got a group out there right now run by, you know, that's led by a whole bunch of mercenary groups that want to create concentration camps within military bases in the United States, initially to round up immigrants. All right. What do you think, and who do you think they're going to put in those in those concentration camps after they deal with the immigrants? They're going to go after the population that doesn't agree with them. That's why this idea of them being able to scoop up data and more efficiently identify people who may be, quote, enemies to the state, which, guess what, everybody? If you're listening to this show, there's a good chance you'd be on that list. That's why this is so scary. And the fact that you had 21 of the minions say that this is going too far already for us tells you how bad things are, and the fact that we don't even have a sense of how depraved the actions of this rogue organization is.
I think that's a great point, because we know what we know, right? And we're looking at what they're leaving, but we don't know what else may be going on that precipitated that.
We know what Line Barbie, who is the headpiece for this administration, tells us, and that's about it right now, because we don't even have an idea what's going on with inside these groups.
Yeah, I don't think it should have to fall on the citizenry to come up with the worst case scenario. It's like we have all the points exactly right. All these things exist so that you don't. So that one person or one group of people don't control all this information. And in fact, it was somebody in the piece in the Post, I think it was, that said something to the effect that if one person understood all these systems at once and had access to all these systems at once, we would have to shoot them. And I'm only half joking on that. That was his quote, not mine. It's, you know, the government has over the years, I think I still have a bookmark about an article on what was called, I think, the total information system that the Bush administration had tried to implement, and Congress quashed it. And they said, no, we are not going to have a total information system on our citizenry. The idea that I just want to go to what Fran said and what you said as well, that, you know, how bad is it when 21 people quit? It's how many people have been quitting in government. And as Fran pointed out, now they don't know how they're going to pay their mortgage. They don't know how they're going to. You don't quit your job that lightly, especially a career, unless something is really going wrong in government. And this idea, I think a court ordered the Doge team to destroy all copies in the meantime of any data they had downloaded. If you think for one minute they are doing that, you know, what you could fit on a thumb drive, I'm sure a few of these kids, and I call them kids, they're probably in their 20s, at home, have this really cool thing that they like to show off to their friends, the same way that Donald Trump used to like to show off classified information that he took with him to Mar-a-Lago after he left. It blows your mind.
And Jay, do you think the FBI is going to enforce the law?
And that's the final point that I actually wanted to make, that when you take all that information, when you take your bank accounts, when you take your medical information, when you take your Social Security information, all the other things that separate agencies have, and you take a guy like Dan Bongino and put him in charge of the FBI or number two at the FBI, you are... I think you're right on the edge of that dystopian future, and it just takes someone willing to go into it.
All right. We're going to pause and take a break. When we come back, we will continue the conversation and talk about many of the other stuff that is going on. We welcome your letters, as always, panel at wamc.org, panel at wamc.org. We'll have about 15 or 20 minutes. I want to go into some media press issues with Jay and the rest of the group when we come back, and we'll do that. Again, we welcome your letters. We'll get to a few more of them. Panel at wamc.org. Panel at WAMC.org, and we will return after this break in news from the BBC. Mm-hmm. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion. We have a about 15 minutes left with this group and a lot to discuss. Initially, when we were putting things together and I was looking at stuff to talk about last night and sending it out to the group, I wanted to talk about the story that where now the White House would choose who's going to be a part of the White House press corps and be there daily to cover the White House. That is one story. Then we just heard just a few minutes ago on the BBC that there is this this other story that has come out that Trump is threatening to sue the media outlets for anonymous sources in made up stories and is looking to do what he calls a nice new law. Against authors.
Does that go with the big beautiful bill?
Yeah, exactly. And the gorgeous green gold card or whatever the hell it is. Against authors who use anonymous sources in books about him or his allies, calling them defamatory. And then just as microphone was about to open up, there was a story that went out on both the New York Times and the New York Times site that the opinion editor for the Washington Post, David Shipley, is leaving. He is exiting as he says Jeff Bezos is steering the editorial page and the paper into a new direction. And Bezos, the owner of the Post, said that the newspaper's opinion section would focus on personal liberties and free markets, is what he said. I am of America and for America. I'm proud to be so, Mr. Bezos said in an email to the Post's employees just this morning. Our country did not get here by being typical, and a big part of America's success has been freedom in the economic realm and everywhere else. Freedom is ethical. It minimizes coercion and practical. It drives creativity, invention, and prosperity. In his note, Mr. Bezos said that he asked Mr. Shipley whether he wanted to stay at the Post, and Mr. Shipley said, no, I don't. I suggested to him that if the answer wasn't hell yes, then it had to be no. Yee.
There's so much there.
Yeah.
First of all, Shipley, mazel tov, but he had the chance a few months ago, to take a stand when he kind of explained away the decision not to do an endorsement. And it was lame. It was, you know, anybody that's worked in journalism could see that the reason they didn't do, I'm mixing up two issues. The cartoon.
Yes.
The cartoon in which a Post cartoonist had a number of people, including Jeff Bezos, bowing to paying homage to a statue of Trump. And they didn't print that. And his reason for it was he had some reason for it. And it was lame. And anybody that had worked in journalism would know that the reason that cartoon didn't run was because it was critical of Jeff Bezos, and Shipley should have just admitted that. And Bezos probably didn't like the cartoon because cartoons are special. They carry a certain weight, probably almost as much weight as an editorial, and it feels like the opinion of the newspaper. Anyway, that's almost an aside. I missed the, what was the term that they used? Free markets and...
Oh, let me get it back here. Personal liberties and free markets.
Right. So this is this is just another barely changed phrasing from the theme of Reason Magazine, which is the head, you know, kind of the house organ of the libertarian movement, which is free minds and free markets. So this is a whole new direction for the Washington Post if that's where they're going. So that's the Post. But the the Trump administration coming out with this announcement that they are going to pick and choose who's going to be in the pool is you know, they're emboldened, I think, by the decision. I think it was the same day or the day before that a judge in the Associated Press Access case said that he wouldn't immediately do an injunction. And they took the wrong message from that judge's decision.
And just to go back, but that decision was about the Associated Press putting out the, for most people know this, but the Associated Press has a style guide and will often dictate to members of the journalistic establishment of how things should be covered. And in this case, they said, okay, we believe, we've studied these matters. You can call it Denali National Park because that's in the United States of America. However, you can't, it doesn't make sense to call it the Gulf of America because that's not what it's called.
Right.
And they went to the mat on that, and that is then why this came about.
Right. And they are an international body.
Yes.
That covers international issues, so and is published in internationally, and it wouldn't make sense to the rest of the world to hear. You know, it's absurd. So, so the judge said, what the Trump administration may have missed is what the judge said to the Trump administration and the Trump's lawyers is, you're probably wrong on this. And this is a First Amendment issue, and what you've done does not square with the First Amendment. But, and this is where I think the judge made a mistake, he said the issue isn't so dire that it calls for a preliminary injunction. We'll work this out at trial, essentially, or when we get to the question of whether we're going to do a permanent, there's a permanent injunction, there's the temporary restraining order. He wasn't ready to do a temporary measure because he didn't feel it was dire enough. I would argue, and I was ranting in my house yesterday about this, that any time somebody infringes on a right, it's dire enough that if a judge can see on its face, so to tell the lawyers for the plaintiff, for the defendants in this case, the White House, you're going to lose this case. Basically, I can see it already. Your reasoning is lame here. He should have just said, your reasoning is lame here. They're going to, Associated Press is going to prevail at trial, and I'm gonna say you can't do this now. But essentially, he's saying, well, if you want to break the law till we have a trial, I guess that's okay. But by the time we get to trial, you really ought to think your position on breaking the law. I don't know how many people get a buy like that except Donald Trump. So I'm just livid all around with this and this new idea that they can control who's going to be in the White House press corps instead of the White House Correspondents Association is an obvious infringement on the free press.
One of the things that I kept reading about this, and I know this goes over and over again, and in some case, you know, I can hear people yelling back at the radio going, yeah, idiot, meaning to me, you know, this has been going on for a long time, and I understand that. But one of the things that struck me in this particular case is that, because it's a great example of it, I guess, is what I'm getting at, is that in talking about why of how the White House press corps is chosen and does their business, the article when it came out, both in the New York Times and in the Washington Post, talked about how it went against precedent. And so much of what we're seeing now goes against precedent. And it's just as that's all we have to go on is precedent as opposed to a rule, a law, a firm edict that this is the way it's supposed to be, as if everyone thought, well, you can just, you know, it'll just be precedent because no one's going to be vile enough to screw around with that.
Like Roe v. Wade.
So that was exactly my question. It's these guys don't care about precedent. They don't care about the informal ways of doing things or practice or best practice. But what's the actual law that covers who gets to hear this information and how they are chosen? Is there any actual law or regulation?
I would say that the law probably is going to be a judicial interpretation of the First Amendment.
Right.
I don't think anybody ever even thought to write a law that says here's what the White House can and cannot do, because, you know, this is something that developed over time. And, you know, as hostile as relations have been sometimes, and I'm not a White House press corps historian, so there may have been times that, you know, one president or another did this, and I'm sure some whataboutist will find a case where, you know, John Kennedy threw stormfront people out of the White House or something. The question is who controls. Who sets foot in the door of the White House to hear the president? You know, if you take it that simply, this looks like, well, that's their prerogative. But the prerogative may be, in the court's view, the issue may be viewpoint discrimination, and that this is government doing something that the court has clearly said you cannot discriminate against people, against media organizations, against protesters, against anything on the basis of what they publish or believe.
I just want to make one quick, we have about 3 minutes here, but we've had members of this panel in the past who have said, well, look, these press conferences that they're doing are just abysmal anyway. Like, you don't need to be in that White House press, or you don't need to be in the Correspondents Association. Go out and do your job. Go out and report. And that could actually be better than being a ball in a chain to the White House, where the disinformation is swirling around.
And I would argue that that what you want in the White House at the press conferences asking questions is people who are experienced, people who have an agenda, which is to get to the truth, and get through the spin. And you need that as well as people on the street, you know, reporters on the street doing investigative work and doing their beats. You need both. And to suggest that, well, if you don't have that, you can go do that. It's not either or.
90 seconds.
I still worry. You know, I think about Clarence Thomas and his desire to overturn the Sullivan case, New York Times versus Sullivan, with the idea that the government and public officials should have the right to censor the free press. This is another step in that direction. And again, what we're seeing in the first four weeks of this administration is a wholesale assault on our fundamental civil liberties, and anybody who is listening should be outraged and be prepared to act on it.
Well, we will end this segment with the words of Ray, a listener, who writes to us and says, "Gee willikers, guys, you're scaring the bejesus out of me."
I'm sorry, Ray.
You should be scared.
I wasn't scared too, Ray. I'm right with you, my friend.
It's not the intention, but, you know, it is the reality, right, of what we're looking at, of how we interpret it and see it.
And it's not a bad thing
to
realize that it's worse than maybe you want it to be.
That's your homework assignment.
Oh, happy news? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, I'll get working on that, Fran.
It's not snowing in Northampton. There you go.
Okay. My thanks to Fran Berman, Jay Jochnowitz, and Bob Griffin. Terrific panel. So thoughtful. And I appreciate all of you being here. And it really is wonderful to have your input and counsel. We will be back with more program right after this.